Mister.
Hello, WGN listening audience.
Live from the biggest small town in America, it's the Saturday Night Special with Amy Goode.
Tonight's radio special is, straightforwardly, about whiskey. Whether you spell it with or without an E, the bronze-colored spirit is far more than just alcohol. It's history in a bottle, it's an art form, and in many ways, it's alchemy. And its story is a fascinating one, with a long history of being hidden and enjoyed in secret, even long before Prohibition was a thing. Getting its humble start in 13th century Italy, it spread into Ireland and Scotland by the 15th century. Here in the U.S., it was even used as currency around the time of the American Revolution. And during Prohibition, which we will talk about tonight, whiskey was the notable exception of spirits not banned. Just as long as you had a doctor's prescription and brought it and bought it through a licensed pharmacy, whiskey could be legally obtained just fine. France leads the world in whiskey consumption, per capita anyway, with the U.S. coming in third place. As of 2017, nearly 39 million Americans enjoy some form or another of whiskey on the regular. Whiskey's meant to be unintimidating and accessible, and yet it too is having a moment in the craft spirits realm, in which language has begun to circle around it that's akin to the language of wine, the notes, the finish, the barrel, and suddenly our straightforward friend in the flask is rather fancy. But let us not lose sight of its simplicity. It's an easy-to-find liquor, but in every bottle there is no doubt a story. The story of the alchemy of taking grain, mixing it with tradition and history, regional flavors like smoked peat moss or spices, to create something unique that always bears its, pun intended, maker's mark. Whether we use it to toast our success or drown our sorrows, whiskey is our familiar companion. It goes by many names in many parts of the world and connects past and present and every corner of the globe. So whether single malt, blended, rye, scotch, bourbon, neat, on the rocks, tonight we'll raise a proverbial glass to explore the life and legacy of whiskey. We'll talk with a local distillery about making spirits on the backdrop of the temperance movement, with a historian about Prohibition in Chicago, and with a curator and tasting expert about how to approach the throne of this mighty spirit. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special, and as ever, we take one big topic and we spend the whole evening talking all about it. And this is a topic esteemed producer Tom Hush and I have been talking about doing for a while, because it's a topic I think it's fair to say we're both fans of this topic, and that topic is whiskey.
Yes, enthusiastic.
we're enthusiastic supporters of this. We're enthusiastic supporters of all of our topics, but I think especially this one. And that's how this show came about, because we were kind of talking about, well, hey, what are you going to drink after the show?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, you mentioned a Glenlivet. Yeah, you were going to go home and try out.
I don't know if I need to try it. I'm pretty familiar with its work. That's a nice little go-to one, you know.
Totally, yeah.
To have that one.
If people have asked me before, like, I'm not a huge Scotch drinker, but they're like, hey, what kind of? If you order a Scotch, what are you going to get? Most of the time, I'm going to go for a Glenlivet, or if I want something kind of smoky, I'll go for a Laphroaig.
There you go.
There's some people that are really into Scotch that can tell you anything.
Yeah. You're more of a rye guy, yeah.
Yes. I fell in love with rye whiskey a while ago, and it's my favorite. It's my go-to. Everybody's got a go-to when it comes to whether it's whiskey or anything else. You got to have your go-to. And personally, I'm a big fan of Bullet Rye.
Good.
That was my first rye whiskey. And then tried out a little bit of Few Distilleries rye whiskey, and that's also very nice.
That's
very
a good
nice
one.
Taste.
So what was your path into whiskey?
So my dad immigrated from Scotland in the 80s, and you know, we've always been very in touch with our Scottish heritage, and I guess once I came of age, I figured that
the water of my people.
Yeah, I had to embrace it. I was like, I must know, you know, what the whole thing is. And I remember that my first scotch that I ever had was in like the Wyndham Hotel or whatever. We were doing like a staycation in the city, and they had a bar. I was like, you know what? Give me a scotch and soda. That seems like something a 21-year-old would drink. And I absolutely hated it. Okay. It was really rough on me. And the bartender could even tell. They were just like, oh, man, you're really not enjoying that, right? And I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm not. And the bartender.
They made you a Cosmo instead?
I wish. No, he decided to, he said, here, try just like a little bit of this. And he gave me a bit of Glenlivet and kind of described, like, you want to look for that smokiness, kind of take a moment with it. It's not going to be as much fun as downing bourbon, because bourbon is generally so sweet compared to scotch. But over time, I came to enjoy the different flavors of scotch and try a few different things. Again, I'm not a scotch expert, but I started to see the broad appeal of it.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah, it's the story of Tom and scotch. you could write a book.
Very, very touching story. So there is a great list that I have created here, because I don't want to test your knowledge, but let's talk about some scotch and whiskey and bourbon stuff, right? Mm-hmm. The oldest whiskey is 150 years old.
Wow.
How about that? It holds the Guinness World Record. It was packaged sometime in the late 1850s, something like that, at an Irish family still, and it was auctioned off in London for around £15,000. So you do the math on that one.
£15,000.
Not cheap is what I'm
saying.
No,
yeah. And that's, so it's like older than the Civil War.
The Macallan M whiskey, though, is the most expensive in the world.
How much?
Again, we're going to have to do some transatlantic math here. So it was auctioned off this year in Hong Kong for £400,000.
Oh, wow.
So again, not cheap.
£400,000 sterling.
Yeah.
Woof. I mean, how do you even drink? I'm guessing they're not going to drink it. Or if you do, like, no whiskey tastes that good. You could be like, yeah, this is a really good whiskey, but it's not £400,000 good. Or maybe it is. I don't know.
I will never know is the thing about that.
Yeah, we'll never know. But if I pay more than a certain amount, I'm like, yeah, this $200 bottle of whiskey is really good. But is it $200 good?
No. So tonight on the show, we're going to be talking with lots of folks. We're going to be talking with a professor about the history of Prohibition in Chicago around whiskey and those kind of things. I'm very excited for that, because I think, we'll get into this with him, but I think like Prohibition is like
it's part of the American like mythos.
So a lot of, like, we know what it is basically. Like, we know this amendment and this amendment. Like, we know 18th and 21st. We know that. We kind of know, oh, it's when you couldn't drink. There's a lot of other stuff. And I think what's going to be interesting about that segment is I really want to set the context of what was happening in history in that moment and what led up to it that allowed that to occur, and then what led it to be repealed.
And definitely something I think I'm excited to hear about is how much did it affect the American drinking culture? Because, you know, every country you go to has a specific attitude towards alcohol. Like, if you go to Italy, the attitude towards drinking is slightly different. You know, you're going to drink a little bit more wine with more meals. People are generally allowed to drink a little bit younger. But from what I've found, like, going out and getting drunk is not really part of the culture. Whereas in America, it's a little bit more common where people go
out. We're all about
the
binge drinking. For reals.
That's fun. Most of the time.
No.
Until the next day.
No. And here's the thing is, like, I've got a couple years on you, Tom.
Sure.
So here's the thing. There is a time in your life when you can live it up and get up and go to work the next morning and you're fine. You're like, meh, I'm a little parched, but I can make it. And then there is a threshold in which you can just no longer do that. That just doesn't exist anymore. It takes less and less.
Oh, I'm not looking forward to
that.
I'm
just letting you know there's going to be a time in your life you're going to have a little bit of scotch or something, wake up in the next day and go, I can't do it today.
No.
Not going to do it.
Not today. What about your experience with whiskey? I know you like...
I enjoy it.
A nice dram here and there.
I do enjoy a wee dram, as your people would say. I don't know that I had like a story into it. I mean, I don't... I'm not connected to any of the lands that are, you know... Well, although... something we learned today leading up to the show is France is the top whiskey consuming country in the world.
That honestly blows my mind.
That's my people. So
very nice.
So that's fine.
Well, and you have a type of whiskey named after you. Well, after a certain set of people. Bourbon.
Oh, I was like, there's a Guth.
No, yeah.
What? There's a Guth whiskey and you're just now telling me this?
There's not a Guth whiskey.
There should be. Well, there will be eventually is the thing. Yeah. That's what's going to happen.
I think you've got some more facts there as well.
I do, but other things on the show that are coming up. I'm very excited about this. We're going to be talking with Fred Minnick, who wrote Bourbon Curious, a simple tasting guide for the savvy drinker, and who wrote a book called Bourbon, the Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of an American Whiskey. He's also the editor of Bourbon Plus magazine. We're going to be talking with him about the history of bourbon too, but kind of where your access points are, where you want to get into bourbon, where you want to try it. Because here's my worry. As things get to a craft movement place, I'm afraid of things getting shrouded in mystery. And I think especially something as straightforward as whiskey, something that's supposed to be so simple and accessible, I don't want it shrouded in a lot of mystery. So that's going to be part of the show tonight as well. And then a little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking with Paul Hiletko, who is the founder of Few Distillery and a really, really interesting person. And we're going to learn a lot of stuff from him. Perhaps there'll be, speaking of a wee dram, perhaps there will be a wee dram.
I will neither confirm nor deny the existence of the wee dram.
You set the interview up, man.
I did.
So that's the plan for the show. You know, I know I was a little nervous to do this show because I thought, you know, I don't want to... It's not about drinking to me. And frankly, I think like, I don't know, everybody has a different approach to doing radio, but mm-hmm. I always feel bad if I like have food or drinks or something on the air because it feels like, nah, 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 to the listener. I want to share stuff. I don't want to do stuff the listener can't experience. I want to experience things together because that's the whole, my whole thing of getting guests is I want to, the listeners and I will learn things from guest. So I feel like if I'm like, this is delicious, you can't have it. It's just not fair.
Well, you know, if you'd like to play the Saturday Night Special drink along game, feel free to run out to your local, liquor store, pick up a little Few, and you can drink along with Guth.
Okay, you say that. There is a drinking game.
That there is.
There is a printed thing. We'll have to find it and tweet it out or something. But there is, it was like, drink every time Guth says the word narrative.
Yeah.
And what were the, I don't remember all of them.
There was a lot, but you wouldn't survive, I don't think. Most people would survive.
You'd be done. You'd be totally done because they were all, yeah, they're all like
most common things that you say on air.
Well, and every host has those, but.
Sure, yeah.
Don't say it like that. That's so mocking. Yeah, no. I say narrative a lot because that's the whole.
That's what we're talking about.
The game of the show is like, what is the narrative? What is hidden in the narrative? What is not being said in the narrative?
It is what you do best.
Uncover narratives.
Uncover narratives.
Yeah, so we're uncovering narratives around whiskey and prohibition and not just the alcohol itself, but the history of it, how it came to be. Where does it stand culturally, I think, is really what we're kind of after tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine a world without whiskey, honestly.
I don't want
to. It's weird, because even when if I go out to a place, especially, like, you think of the classical idea of the beer and shot joint, especially here in Chicago. Like, there's, you know, a specific type of dive bar that you go to, and you're just getting a beer and a shot. And I honestly could not imagine, if I'm getting a beer and a shot, I would like a beer and a shot of whiskey. I don't really drink any other spirits. They don't have as much character, and maybe that's because of my ignorance. I don't really know much about fine vodkas or rums or really anything else. There's just such variance with whiskey.
I don't know why you said that in a funny way, but you did. Fine vodkas or rums was funny. Okay, I have another little piece of knowledge for you from my whiskey factoid list, and that is Mountain Dew was created specifically to be a whiskey chaser.
If I saw someone chase whiskey with a Mountain Dew, I would definitely look at them funny. I'd be like,
because it sounds disgusting.
Whiskey and Mountain Dew?
I can't imagine. Well, see, now we got to do it.
I can't even. What would that taste like? Because Mountain Dew is just so. Well, I guess this is the original intent. the Mountain Dew of today is not
like probably a very different thing.
Not that I drink anymore, but
yeah, David,
Mountain Dew as a what?
That's what I'm saying.
Excuse me?
Yeah,
I can see a vodka Mountain Dew.
Ew!
You can mix vodka with anything.
Oh no!
Well, I mean, none of it sounds right to me.
No.
Well, when you're 15 years old and you're just trying to, you're trying new things, you'll mix anything. Honestly.
I feel
bad. That's very young, but
I feel like personally persecuted because you know my Kahlua and Pepsi story, Tom. That was my foray into Dad's liquor cabinet.
Wait a minute. I used to do Old Granddad and Coke, so hey.
Meow.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
That bites.
We're getting punchy, but we got to get focused. We got to get ready because we are going to get you to news. We're going to take a break first. And on the other side of news, I'm very, very excited. We're going to be talking to our first guest, Fred Minnick, who is going to share a lot of knowledge with us about bourbon. He is a bourbon curator, a tasting expert, and an author, and a show host, all those things. He's going to join us by phone, and we're going to talk with him. So first, let us take a break. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is a Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with us. So tonight, as ever, we pick one big topic, and we spend the whole program talking about it. And that topic tonight is whiskey, my friends. It is a topic I think we can all get behind. And so to help us do that, we've brought in a lot of very smart people to talk with us about that. And how could we possibly have a show about whiskey without bringing in this next guest? Joining us by phone is Fred Minnick, author, bourbon curator, tasting expert, all of those things. Fred, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So there's so many things I want to ask you about because you do so many things, but I would like to start by asking about your initial interest into the study of bourbon.
Well, I can say it started on the balcony of my 21st birthday, and I had a bottle of Jim Beam in my hand at the Delta Chi fraternity house, and that was consumed responsibly. And I began my journey as a legal bourbon drinker, and I was fascinated with bourbon. I loved the taste of it, from early on. And I was I had a career as a science writer, and I was studying forestry, and then I was also in the military. I got sent to Iraq, and when I came back from Iraq, I started writing about food and wine and spirits. And, you know, when you're a freelancer, you kind of write about everything. And bourbon was the one thing that really I gravitated toward. It was because of the history. It was the people. It was the culture. And there were so many fascinating stories that had yet to be uncovered. And I basically have challenged myself to find them. And it kind of began with my first book, Whiskey Women, The Untold Story of How Women Saved Bourbon, Scotch, and Irish Whiskey, and where I found all these incredible women that had a huge impact on all whiskeys, and no one had ever really talked about them.
And I'm fascinated by that. So where does that story even begin, and who are those leading heroines?
So the story of women and whiskey really began with the creation of beer. Beer, you know, whiskey is essentially distilled beer, and Sumerian women were, you know, the creators of that as far as, you know, we can tell. And women were also very prominent in the early distillation. You know, prior to us distilling for alcohol, they were distilling metals, and the Alexandrian chemists had a lot of women in it. And then you get in the Middle Ages, women were distillers. In fact, when we started seeing the witch trials, if a woman was kind of caught with, you know, distillation techniques and her neighbor didn't like her, they would out her as a witch oftentimes, because distillate was considered to be proof that you were a witch. And then when we have actual brands, you see women own brands like Dalmore and Bushmills. And then you get into the 1900s, there's a woman by the name of Bessie Williamson who basically managed Lefroy in Scotland during World War II and became one of the most iconic people for bringing scotch into the United States in the 1960s. In the United States, there's no greater story of a woman than Maker's Mark's Marjorie Samuels, who created the name and the red wax for Maker's Mark. So women have been littered throughout whiskey history. They've just not been talked about a lot.
In one of your other books, there's this wonderful little anecdote about running into a woman who said she was a relative of Elijah Craig and saying, you know, I'm related to the founder of bourbon. And you kind of had to break this news to her in this kind of lovely way. You know, the way it's worded in the book is like, I'm not proud of the next few minutes, but I had to tell her the truth. This is how it went. And so who does get that credit for inventing bourbon?
Well, it's funny. Like, bourbon is this, it's a very storied industry that there's so much folklore in it that the folklore becomes a part of the history. And Elijah Craig is one of the greatest examples in that book you referenced, was my book, Bourbon Curious. In my other book, Bourbon, The Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of American Whiskey, I spent a lot of time actually trying to find out who I believe created the first drops of bourbon. And I settled on this guy named Jacob Spears, who was distilling in a couple different counties in Kentucky in the 1780s and the 1790s, and is noted as being the very first distiller in Bourbon County, Kentucky. And the reason why I point toward Jacob Spears as being the most likely person is because there were a lot of stories circling around him in the 1800s and in the early 1930s when people were talking about who created bourbon. That was really the first time we saw it come up in like a congressional setting, is in the 1930s. But when bourbon was trying to become a unique product in the United States, they were trying to break down some tariff doors in the 1950s and 1960s. They decided to go with a legend that Elijah Craig had invented bourbon on the same day that George Washington was sworn into office. And so they were trying to make bourbon to be very uniquely American. They came up with this this story that he found that discovered charred oak barrels when his barn caught fire and the insides of a barrel were charred. And the new charred oak barrel is what is quintessential bourbon, is what makes it different from all the other whiskeys out there, because by our laws, the whiskey has to go into a new charred oak barrel every single time. And so when they were pushing for this to become a unique product in the United States, they were saying that Elijah Craig, oh, by the way, was a Baptist minister, was the guy who created this. And so they were trying to create this narrative, if you will, that it was uniquely American, made by a religious man. And it helped them sell the fact that, you know, it was an American spirit. And so in 1964, Congress declared bourbon to be a unique product of the United States, and it's our only liquid that has that designation.
Well, it sounds downright wholesome when you put it like that, when you're talking about a minister creating it and all that. I like that. And so to move forward from there, it seems like right now, you know, we're in this moment of the craft cocktail and small batch this and that, and it seems to be having kind of this moment where people are seeking out that is not necessarily mass produced. People are looking for that smaller barrel, that smaller batch of things. What is this moment to you as far as bourbon is concerned, and what's on the other side, or what's kind of right next on the horizon?
Well, this is my life. You know, I started a magazine called Bourbon Plus. I write books. I have a TV show on Amazon Prime called Bourbon Up. I mean, I'm all in. You know, I want to cover every angle of bourbon I possibly can, tell the history of it. But more than that, it's the culture. If you take a look at the people in Kentucky and Illinois and Montana, Wyoming, wherever, they're all very uniquely passionate about, you know, creating something special. And there is story to it, but there is so much craft. Like, when you make whiskey, you're helping farmers, and they're purchasing corn that's usually within 100 miles of their distillery. So they're supporting agriculture. And then once they distill it, the spent grains actually go back to feed livestock. So it's kind of like a full circle. Whiskey is so important to our economy. Right now, you know, we in Kentucky, there's something like $250 million of taxes paid every year to the state. You have the education system here is supported by alcohol taxes, specifically bourbon. About 60% of every bottle of bourbon that you buy, you know, goes to taxes. And a lot of that's earmarked for the local schools and roads in the respective counties. So when you are purchasing Kentucky bourbon especially, you are literally helping the children of Kentucky.
Again, it sounds downright responsible when you put it that way, and so, so wholesome. We're talking with Fred Minnick, author, bourbon curator, tasting expert, show host, all of these things. We're going to take a quick break and continue this conversation with him back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one topic and we talk about it all night. And that topic tonight is whiskey. And how could we possibly have a conversation about whiskey without bringing in an expert? We're joined by Fred Minnick, who is an author, a show host on Amazon Prime. He's a bourbon curator and tasting expert. He knows a lot of stuff. He's written a lot of books. Go find them, read them. They're all fascinating and so good. And he is with us by phone. Fred, so before the break, we were talking a bit about the history of bourbon, but I want to shift now a little bit and talk about tasting, because sometimes when we think about tasting, we immediately think of like a stuffy wine setting and it gets very intimidating. So for someone who is wanting to know more about bourbon and access it and learn more, where do you suggest someone starts in terms of tasting?
Well, I really like to send people to a bar. And in Chicago, you have one of the best bars in the world called Delilah's.
I totally agree. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, so you want to go somewhere where you don't want to buy a bottle and then bring it home and taste. You want to do it at a bar where you can assess it and you have someone there who's got some knowledge and can kind of coach you through it a little bit. But really, and bourbon is not like wine. There's not a stuffy feel to it. And we're very good about saying, like, drink it however you want. Now, I'm a critic, so I assess things and I make recommendations, but I hope that never comes off as snobby. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, when you taste bourbon, you know, you kind of want to drink it how you like it. But I like it. I like it neat. Like right now, are you guys drinking bourbon at the same time? Because I am.
I will neither confirm nor deny.
But what I like to do is it really begins with the aromatic properties. So what you want to do is you want to pour yourself a couple ounces and you want to waft it around your nose a little bit and you want to smell it and you take in that bouquet. And when you smell it, you want to actually smell it with your mouth open. So you get your nose there by the glass and you open your mouth, because that helps the olfactory kind of cycle it out. You may even taste a little bit on the way out, but what it does is it doesn't let that alcohol kind of like burn your nose. So you get, it opens up your nose a little bit. And then after you've kind of made some notes and assessed a little bit of what it smells like, you want to taste it. And you just want to get a little bit on your palate and just kind of feel it on the tip of your tongue and kind of let it drip back. The very best bourbons will kind of coat it and just drip down your jawline like butter. And so, and then after that, you've got the finish. And the finish is how long it's on there. And if it burns at any point, then it's not smooth for you, you know, so you might want to add some water. But every bourbon's different. Every person is different in terms of what they taste and you know, how they might be impacted by it.
That's a great tip. I've never heard that tip to open by smelling it with your mouth open. But that's a great point. That makes perfect sense once you say it.
Yeah, I mean, and really, and I've judged a lot of competitions. Everyone has their own style. You know, for me, the aromatic property is where it all starts. You know, some people just like going straight to the taste. I mean, and honestly, there are some people who just drink straight out of the bottle. I don't recommend that. But
no judgment.
But yeah, I don't recommend it. But it's everybody's different. But yeah, when it comes down to it, if you want to like study it from an analytical perspective, you know, you want to start the nose. But if you're like just wanting to have a good time, you know, you don't really care about, you know, breaking down the spirit or the mash bill, then hey, let's do the cocktail route. And again, I can't say it enough, but you've got a lot of great bars there in Chicago. You got Untitled, you got Delilah's, you got Violet Hour. I mean, you have all these great places where you can really learn one drink at a time.
Yeah, and I think that's key, and that's so far what I'm really hearing echoed from you again and again is, you know, as much as I kind of fret as I was, like, doing research for the show and getting ready for it, I kept coming across so much content that was really all about people diving in so deeply with bourbon that I was beginning to fret that maybe there was something like wine tasting culture building up around it. But what I'm hearing from you is it's here to be accessible and here to stay that way, which I'm relieved to hear.
Yeah, the bourbon culture, if anything, it's the anti wine culture, in that, you know, when people, you generally will see people correct those who will tell you to drink it how you want, you know, they don't say drink it how you want. So it's very accepting, and you'll find that, you know, people want you to just have a good time. But, you know, there's that side, and then there's the analytical side, which, you know, for me as a critic, I have to you know, make my opinion, but I would never tell anybody that you know, they should drink a certain way, unless they're wanting to, you know, pour Coca-Cola with a $500 bourbon or something. You know, that's not acceptable.
Like ketchup on a filet mignon, right? Definitely.
Yeah, or just, you know, of course, what would be worse would be drinking vodka. You know, I heard you all in the pre-show, or before I came on, talking a little bit about vodka. And going back a little bit to the history, vodka is the reason why bourbon kind of fell, one of the big reasons why bourbon fell off in the 1960s and 70s, is everyone started drinking it. And so I have, like, this probably an unhealthy hate toward the spirit, but it's because I love bourbon so much.
An irrational hatred of vodka. No, I'm with you on that. I'm a bourbon lady myself, a whiskey lady myself anyway, for sure. Yes. So, well, but you mentioned that role of the critiquing things for competition. What are the aspects you're looking for in a bourbon when you're in that judge role?
So the first thing that I'm looking for is to make sure, like, it doesn't have any, like, you know, anything bad going for it. So, like, sometimes I will pick up a bourbon or a spirit that smells like sweaty gym socks or like a garbage can. And it's from bad distillation or fermentation, whatever it's from, it's not getting anything from me. Mm-hmm. Then I look for, okay, once I'm past, like, there's no bad there, I'm looking for what are the goods. And then I kind of assess, like, what's coming off of the nose. Is it floral? Is it fruity? Is it confectionery? Is it spicy? And then from there, I'm breaking down specifically, what are those spices? Is it jalapeno? Is it cinnamon? You know, on the fruit side, is it dried apricot, or is it a baked apple pie? And so I'll do that. And then from when I taste it, I want to see exactly where it hits my palate. If it hits on the back palate first and then comes forward, that leaves an impression on me one way. If it hits it on the front of the palate and goes back, that leaves an impression another way. Both very good. But if it just hits the palate and then goes away, that's a negative impression for me, because that's telling me that it doesn't have the structure that I want, you know, for a good sipping whiskey, which that's in basically my entire career is built around sipping whiskey. And, you know, after I've kind of assessed, like, how it hits the mouth, I'm then picking up the flavors. And so you get those spicy notes in the back, you get the more savory ones, like the cornbreads in the middle, and you get the sweet there at the front. And then I want to see what it feels like after I've had assessed the after I've assessed those first notes. Does it drip down the jawline? Does it tickle the roof of my palate? And then I want to see how long the finish is. So the finish is after you've swallowed it, you know, how long is it still on the tongue? What is that residual flavor? And I've had some bourbons that were in and out, hardly any finish at all, and some that lasted as long as 5 minutes. Once I had a bourbon that lasted like 15, 30 minutes and, you know, made my neck hair stand up. So you're always looking for the full experience from a tasting.
And maybe this isn't a question that you can answer, because I might be asking you to kind of pick your favorite child here. But what is your go-to at the end of the day? You go home. What's the bourbon that you said the sipping bourbon? What is that for you?
I get so many. It's probably certifiable how many I got. I mean, tonight I'll just tell you what I'm sipping tonight. I'm drinking a little Russell's Reserve single barrel. That's a Wild Turkey product. This was picked by a retailer in Mississippi called Lincoln Road Package Store. And he does a really good job of picking good barrels. So when I came onto the show, I wanted to taste something, you know, that had, you know, reminded me a little bit of that bourbon culture. And a part of that bourbon culture are these stores, you know, like Benny's, for example, in your market, that come into Kentucky and they pick their own barrels. And, you know, that's a big part of bourbon right now. And that's how you can find some of the best pours in the world. And they're just sitting in those little liquor store shelves.
I love it. I love this. I wish we could keep you for another hour. I have so many other things to ask you, but hopefully you'll join us on the show another time.
You can call me anytime.
Wonderful. We are going to take you up on that. We've been talking with Fred Minnick, author, bourbon curator, tasting expert, Amazon Prime show host, podcast host, all of those things. You can find his books all over the place. They're so good. I highly recommend them. And Bourbon Plus Magazine, another really good one. Thank you so much, Fred. Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us this evening. We are talking tonight about whiskey. We have been talking about the history of it, how to drink it, how to taste it, how to get into it, how to access it, all those things. But how could we possibly have this show, especially in this city, without talking, especially if we're going to talk about history, without talking about prohibition a little bit, right? So here, joining us now is Dr. Kevin Kaufman. He's from Loyola. He's a professor of all things. He has a history podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm going to turn your microphone on and everything.
Oh.
That's the one.
There we go.
That's the one. How are you? Last time you were here was like the music show. We were talking about the history of like live music shows, mm-hmm. and you dropped all kind of wonderful knowledge on us. So we had to bring you back for this
Thank you so much.
For sure. So when we think about Prohibition, I think it's one of those kind of American mythology things we think about. We all go, yeah, that's when no one was drinking.
Right.
But
everybody was drinking.
Or when everybody was drinking. Right. We were just doing it in secret. But what was the context leading up to the 18th Amendment that allowed that to happen? Because I know there was a couple of false starts and things like that.
Right.
But what really was, kind of give us the picture of what was happening right then.
Sure. I mean, that's a dangerous question to start me with because I got too much on that. But the short answer, in a sense, is that it's kind of like you were saying, there was false starts, but there was a kind of a slow buildup. There was, starting really in the 1840s, 50s, there was movement towards, at first, reducing drinking, and then it became more about temperate drinking, and then, of course, the name temperance movement. And it really doesn't pick up steam until after the Civil War of the idea of prohibition, of, no, we're going to stop everybody from drinking. No, there's no such thing as, you know, moderate. There was no kind of in between for a lot of folks at that point.
And so 1850s, that was like the main laws.
Mm-hmm. Right? Correct.
And,
yeah.
Okay. So there was a couple of states that kind of tried this to see what happened. So why did they fail? Why did that not work for those states?
I think in a large part that fails because it's in Maine, as you said, and it really doesn't catch on anywhere else. And it doesn't even really work that effectively in Maine.
Okay.
And it was hyper-localized. That's kind of the big thing about the big switch in the Civil War for a lot of folks is, and a lot of things in government, is it goes from, the United States was very, very provincial. And the Civil War makes things national. You know, it becomes a national issue, and there's much more drive to affect the entire country with your policy. So,
And really, to get the temperance movement going, it was connected to a lot of other issues. I think it was even about like domestic violence and safety and things like that.
Right.
How did that all kind of come together and drive forward?
That really comes together through the women's movement. The women's suffrage and temperance, it's really hard to separate the two and who was involved in doing those things. One of the biggest organizations that comes about, I think about 1879, is the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is still headquartered right here in Evanston,
right up
Illinois.
There in Evanston, yeah.
And that was a driving force for both of those issues. And many other suffragettes, one of their main things was about drinking. And exactly what you said, that Drink led to domestic violence. It led to loss of income, loss of status, loss of stature, all of that kind of stuff. Predominantly in men, too. Women drinking was, you know.
That was a whole other issue.
Oh, my gosh. If that happened, that was the end.
Scandalous thing then. Yeah. So that happens. And yet whiskey in particular, which is tonight's topic, had kind of a special place during that because you could still get whiskey with a prescription, which really did interesting things for kind of the, Walgreens brand in particular. But was that largely driven? I mean, I know that kind of timed out with the big Spanish flu epidemic. So was that largely driven? Was that fear? Was that kind of flying something under the radar? Or was it still being considered highly medicinal at that point?
No, I think it was kind of under the radar, especially as we get into then prohibition. It's still legal for physicians to prescribe alcohol. And whiskey and whatever kinds that they would do, but whiskey was probably the most prevalent. It's interesting. One of the founders of AA, Bob Smith, was a physician, and he actually had friends write him prescriptions for alcohol so he could keep drinking.
Throughout the
1920s. Yeah,
how interesting. So. It has happened. Prohibition has passed, and immediately, as with anything, when you outlaw something, it just goes underground.
Right.
And so, what is happening immediately? What like in the big picture? What are we seeing besides like bootleg and speakeasies and that kind of thing emerge? What else is happening, kind of on a wider scale?
On a wider scale, there was, I think the best way to describe it is, and this is very kind of American politic too. Of, well, we passed the law, we're done. You know, they didn't fund anti-prohibition movements, like law enforcement, things like that. It was the whole time prohibition was around, it was underfunded. You know, that there's famous agents, Elliot Ness, things like that. But that really was uncommon. Through the entire time, there was only 1,500 agents in the entire United States to enforce the Prohibition Act.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I mean, that's nothing,
right?
You know, and so I think that there was, for a lot of folks who helped pass it, the thought was, well, you know, we've done it, no one's going to drink anymore,
good luck with that,
right?
Right,
you know, and it was very popular, at least according to what they thought. I mean, when it passes, it you know, it flies through the Senate, it flies through the House, you know, it gets ratified by the states in about a year. You know, I mean, just think of that happening with anything now.
And no way.
Right.
Nothing.
Nothing is that popular. And so they really thought that, well, obviously everybody's going to respect the law.
That's so interesting.
And so
I wonder if Twitter would have been around then.
Oh, my gosh. That would have been fun.
That would have been really fun to get that kind of that voice of the people feel at that moment, right? Well, so you mentioned Elliot Ness, and when we think of prohibition, we think of Francis Willard on the temperance side. Mm-hmm. We think of Elliot Ness and Al Capone and kind of the untouchables, right? Who were really, I mean, these big players that are when we think of prohibition, who are we missing? I think from the conversation is an important question to ask, but also what was the context of all these people really?
I think of, you know, when you say who are we missing, the way I kind of think of that is all the people who got killed, because it does make Chicago a much more violent place. And you do have, I mean, Al Capone he's kind of almost like a folk hero even today. And really, he was a cold-blooded killer. You know, he helped orphans and helped neighborhoods with food and things like that. But he also ran things extraordinarily, you know, ruthlessly. And Elliot Ness, the one thing about him that I, you know, he brings down Capone for tax evasion. And it's kind of like you didn't really stick that landing.
Right.
You know, that's not what we were going for.
Right, right.
And so, but his star does rise. Yeah. But of course, not as far as you would think. He tried to become mayor of Cleveland a couple of times. Never worked out. He kind of just fades into, you know, obscurity. And I think some of the rival gangs in Chicago, we don't talk a lot about. But then again, Capone does take over. And by the time when I think we talked before we came on, that Capone had made so much money by the time we get to 1930 that he had almost absolute control. I always like to when talking about this too, when I've done like History of Chicago or something like that, is the mayor during that time. His name was Bill Thompson, Big Bill Thompson. He was known as a Capone ally. There's pictures of him at Wrigley Field with Capone.
Well, that seems like a bad move politically. Yeah.
Not at the time, though. Right. You know, and he was famous for saying that if King George came to Chicago, he'd punch him right in the nose. And you know, he just played up that kind of image. Mm-hmm. That, you know, insulting King George, the Irish loved it. You know, and mm-hmm. You know, he just kind of tried to play that the whole time. And he worked with Capone quite a bit.
Interesting. Very interesting. That's why we bring you here. We're talking with Dr. Kevin Kaufman from Loyola. He runs a history podcast. He does lots and lots of things. Follow him. He's on Twitter. I'll tweet out your handle after the program so people can follow him. So lots of good stuff coming from you all the time. But we're going to take a little break. When we come back, more of this conversation about these details and context around Prohibition. More in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And this evening, we are talking all about whiskey. That is our topic. But how could we possibly talk about that topic, especially here in Chicago, without talking about Prohibition? So that's why we have Dr. Kevin Kaufman in with us. We've had him on the show before, and he always brings such wonderful information to us. So we had to have him back for all this. So we were talking about kind of the context of what led to Prohibition and what was happening during that. So I want to fast forward a bit to 21st Amendment happens, repeal. Mm-hmm. What gets that to happen? What is the context there of what's happening? Because it came through, the 18th came through with so much support.
Right.
So what was the feel and the conversation and the narrative happening when it was repealed?
That was a combination of things as well. Always, that's a bad history answer.
It's many things.
It's many things. I have an outline. No, the main thing is that it was obvious it wasn't working to even the most diehard supporters, especially through the 20s when the staunchest ally that we talked about, women, middle class women, start to turn against it. And that really has an effect. There's a lot of decisions of, well, which way are the major political parties going to go on this issue? And in 1928, before it actually gets repealed, the Democrats come out as the wet party. Mm. And a guy by the name of Al Smith, who runs for president, is, you know, painted as this, you know, he wants to make everybody a drunkard, and he's going to, you know, the city's going to become overrun, and it's going to get even worse. And in those short years between his defeat in 28 to Hoover, of course, the Depression hits. Mm-hmm. And one of FDR's famous lines is, someone coming home from work should be allowed to have a beer. Mm. And that made him extraordinarily popular, like a lot of things that he did.
Sure.
And that was a big part of it, too, was that the economic hardship, it was kind of, wow, we're still talking about this, you know, that we've got bigger things to worry about. Whether or not people are drinking or we're making, you know, whiskey or beer or something like that, that was a big part of it too. That I think the failure of it was huge. But then, except for very, very few people, really believed that it was ever going to really work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. And so, well, you mentioned that it started to fail in the eyes of middle-class women who had initially supported it. What caused that? What made people, especially women who were so for it, how did that get separated?
Mm-hmm. That, it's one of those things that reminds me of that phrase, reading the room, is that as the 20s are coming in, things are changing a lot, you know, and even if Prohibition wouldn't have been a big part of it and the speakeasy and all that, there was this movement towards, you know, a much more outward kind of lifestyle, you know, that people were, the dancing and all that kind of stuff. And another thing that was really effective as far as the image of Prohibition and drink was the effect of the First World War, that it was, again, kind of in that same line of thinking of the Depression. It's like, there's a lot worse things in this world going on. And leading up to World War One, for most of the United States and Europe, there was this kind of, you know, progressives and positivism that we can conquer any problem. And then, of course, they, you know, mow each other down in the thousands. And it's like, no, we really can't.
No, yeah.
And that whole moralistic thinking really takes a back seat. And it's right at that time, of course, that it gets put through Congress. And Congress is a little bit behind the times. It probably helped getting it passed initially that it was made. Prohibition was brought in to help the war effort. The idea was that we can't spare all this grain to make whiskey. We have to feed the troops and make sure we have enough food. And so kind of a continuation of that. And right after that, it's kind of like, God, this seems pointless.
Hmm.
And I think that's where a lot of folks kind of came down on it.
Hmm. And yet, I feel like we still see some impact in terms of just cultural attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still have blue laws. Mm-hmm. We still have dry counties, things like that. You know, how do those dots connect where these attitudes stay even so long after mm-hmm. that repeal?
I think that's the places where prohibition was probably the most successful were where you're going to find those dry counties, rural, southern, that it still has that image. The evangelical strain is still very strong, and that was a big player in the prohibition movement as well. So there's that. What's interesting, a couple of years back, and I can't remember the name of the book or the author, but somebody brought up the interesting point that in some ways prohibition was a success, because when you look at how much Americans were drinking prior, and then of course even though it's famous for being this period of drink and everything, mm-hmm. alcohol consumption just bottoms out during prohibition. And it never got to the same levels until the late 70s, early 80s. And now it's lower still. We're actually below where it was prior to prohibition. That maybe there was something to some of this of, you know, maybe alcohol isn't harmless, as people were trying to bring up too.
So outside of economic factors, at that mm-hmm. time of the repeal, where was the greatest benefit to be found? I mean, we're mentioning like health factors, that maybe it did work in that way. Certainly mm-hmm. people are, there's money to be made again in a legal way, right?
Right.
Who else was benefiting really meaningfully at that point?
You mean from getting alcohol back?
Uh-huh.
Or,
yeah.
Well, benefiting, I would say, I think just culturally, that especially the immigrant communities that felt a lot of pressure from prohibition. I mean, that was in some ways the most targeted aspect of prohibition. Leading up to prohibition, the saloon was seen as the great evil. I mean, the number one organization against drinking was called the Anti-Saloon League.
Mm-hmm.
And because they held so much power in the community. And I think that kind of gets to revive itself a little bit. That aspect of, you know, the corner bar and the tavern, and while it's still not married to politics as it once was, I think that gets a big shot in the arm. Mm-hmm. That is, again, especially through the 30s and into before the World War, before World War II, that kind of resurfaces a little bit, and there's a building of like ethnic ties that hadn't been as open as they had once been.
Mm-hmm.
That those institutions within the communities were allowed to thrive again. And I think that's really good and a good thing.
Yeah, so interesting. See, this is why we bring you here, because you give us so much good context for all the things. Because, like, as I said at the beginning of this segment, I think prohibition is one of those things we just think of. That's that time when no one was drinking legally. That's it. But there's really so much nuance to it in class and race and gender and mm-hmm. like all this economic, like all this stuff that I think is so interesting. So I thank you for coming to unpack it all for us, Dr. Kevin Kaufman from Loyola. Again, if you follow me on Twitter, you too can follow him, because I'm going to tweet at you after the program and share
Fantastic.
The podcast and all those things. All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us. So we're going to take a little break, get you news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us this evening. So as ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all night and we take different aspects of it and do our thing, right? So tonight's topic is whiskey. So how in the world could we do a show about whiskey without talking to someone who makes whiskey? And so a little bit earlier today, we had a conversation with Paul Holetko. He is from Few Distillery in Evanston, which I think is really interesting because it's right there where the birthplace of temperance is. So we talked to him a little bit earlier today. Let's take a listen. I'm so glad that you're here. I'm so interested in Few. Just the bottles are like works of art. They're so pretty. But the history is really quite interesting because you're right there in Evanston, which is kind of, it's kind of sticking it to the man to have a distillery in Evanston, given that that's where temperance was kind of the centered.
Sure, it's probably more sticking it to the woman.
Well, that's true, right?
Know, the whole prohibition did start by a group of women and...
Sticking it to Frances Willard, right?
I think there's those that see that, but really she was an amazing woman who was just, you know, really just born much too soon. She really changed the world in a better way. It may seem weird for a... you know, guy who makes whiskey to say that the, you know, doyen of prohibition changed the world for a better way, but she kind of did the best she could with the world she was facing when she was around.
Yeah, fair enough.
And so, you know, we think it's fantastic to make whiskey in Evanston and be part of Chicago, and all of our labels talk about that kind of history of Chicago with the 1893 World's Fair and, you know, bringing the best and the brightest of all over the world to Chicago, even just for a short 6 month period, was pretty special.
Yeah. So what is the story of Few and how you came to start it?
I think the story of Few kind of starts back, you know, way before I was born, as most good stories probably do. But before World War II, my grandfather's family owned what is now a major brewery in the Czech Republic. And in 1939, the Nazis invaded and took it. The whole family was murdered in the camps, with the exception of my grandfather, who survived the war. And then he spent the rest of his life trying to get it back.
Hmm.
He never did. And when he died, it kind of struck me that this entire family legacy, family history, or whatever you want to call it, it's gone forever if I don't do something about it. And so a Few was kind of an attempt to rebuild this family legacy in the beverage alcohol space, but try to do something that's a little bit more positive, something that's ours, something that you know, someday perhaps my grandfather will be looking down or looking up, depending on situations, and be proud of.
Yeah.
Rebuilding a family history.
So through the course of creating the distillery and perfecting the recipes and doing all those things, what was kind of the first step when it was like, okay, this is official, there's no turning back now, this is happening?
Well, I can certainly remember an awful lot of those times where you kind of stop and sit back and go, oh boy, what have I done?
What have I just done?
Oh boy. And it's the same as everything else. You just solve one problem at a time. You can't do any more than that, but hopefully you move on to solve more and more and more problems. And that's what we continue to do for coming up on 8 years now of solving the biggest problems that you can find and trying to make them into, you know, into resources and make it something that works.
Sure. And so what is your philosophy for running the distillery and creating the products that you have?
I think the shortest part, our philosophy at Few is to make art and put it in a bottle. And that's what we try to do each and every day, is make the best whiskey we can, put the best whiskey we can in a bottle, and try to improve every day. We're very focused on the art and the craft and the creativity of making whiskey and trying to push the limits and push what that can be. You know, we think we kind of define the Chicago style of whiskey. We're a little bit bold. We're a little bit brash. We're not trying to be something we're not. We're just trying to do the best we can each and every day.
And in a lot of interviews, you talk about the grain to glass philosophy, and I've seen that thrown around a lot in this space. What does that mean to you?
I think grain to glass is really just kind of a... it's more of a philosophy of creativity. In the spirits world, there are not many places that actually make their own spirits, but Few is one of those few. So we're really proud of the fact that we make all of our own stuff. Everything that has our name was made in our facility by our people using our equipment, aged by us in our facilities, bottled by us using our gear. Everything comes from an actual place. And unfortunately, that's a little bit of a rarity in the spirits business. And so we're pretty proudly grain to glass. We exclaim it from the biggest hill we can find. We'll shout it on top of the radio if we have to, that we actually make all of our own stuff. And to me, it's a philosophy of openness and transparency and most importantly, honesty.
Yeah. And what do people normally like get wrong or not know about whiskey that you feel like you find yourself answering again and again?
I think people get really wadded up in what the proper way to drink whiskey is, and there is no such thing as a proper way to drink whiskey other than the way that you like best. If you get a group of 10 people, you're going to find 10 different ways that people like to drink their whiskey, and each and every one of them is actually
correct.
Yeah.
And so that's what tends to frustrate me. And I see a lot of men coming into the world of whiskey, and I see a lot of women coming into the world of whiskey, and there's far too many people who are intimidated or scared or, oh, I don't like this or I don't like that, and they kind of close themselves off to being open to what you can find. And that frustrates me because there's just so much.
Yeah.
And there's a right whiskey for everyone and a right way to drink that whiskey for everyone. Don't be scared. Come on in. The
whiskey's
fine.
That's right. And so, well, you mentioned that, but you do tours of your facility. You have a tasting room and all this kind of cool stuff.
Absolutely. We do tours. I actually got a tour going on right now. But we bring in people in to let people see, hey, look, there's nothing to be afraid of here. We're taking Midwestern grain, we're cooking it, we're boiling it, and we're collecting the vapors, and that's what whiskey is. There's nothing to be afraid of. There's no shame. It's not a dark secret. It's a delicious product that brings friends and family and people together to share the good times as well as the bad.
That was a conversation that I had earlier today with Paul Haleko, who is the founder of Few Distillery right here in Chicagoland up in Evanston. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll hear the rest of that conversation here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. All night we have been talking about whiskey, and how could we possibly do that without talking to somebody who makes it? So a little bit earlier today, we talked to Paul Haleko, who is the founder of Few Distillery right here in Chicagoland up in Evanston. And we were, before the break, listening to part one of that conversation. Now let's listen to part two. A lot of times when we are thinking about tasting, I think this happens more with wine, but more and more, I think you see it with craft spirits and craft cocktails, and there's kind of this like a vocabulary that's attached to it, and I think that sort of intimidates people. People talk about like the nose on this wine and the nose on this cocktail or this spirit or whatever. Where do you start if someone's kind of interested in learning more and developing a palate around whiskey? Where do you begin when you have sometimes a lot of language that seems kind of hard to unpack?
I think the most important thing is, you know, don't be scared, be open. And I think the best way to start on that journey is to go to a friendly watering hole that is convenient, where you can either drive or not drive or take an Uber home. But go and talk to people. We're blessed here in Chicago to have one of the best whiskey bars on the planet in the shape of Delilah's over on Lincoln, just south of Diversey. You're simply not going to find a more welcoming, friendly place. Granted, it's a motorcycle punk rock bar, so it may not be everybody's cup of tea as far as
it's my cup of tea. I love Delilah's. It's a great
amazing bar.
Yeah, I've been going there for years, and they still have Morrissey and Smith's nights, so I'm in. I'm all over that.
But you know, my number one advice: go to Delilah's, talk to the bartender, say, "Hey, I'm looking to try a whiskey that is sweet. I want to try a whiskey that's really spicy. I want to try a really smoky whiskey." Talk about flavors that you like. You know, Amy, maybe you like apples a lot. Maybe you like cherries. Maybe you like vanilla. Maybe you like smoke. Talk about flavors that you do like, and just tell the guys and the gals at Delilah's, "Hey, I'm looking for something really fruity tonight."
Mm-hmm.
And they'll pick you out a really special whiskey. And if you don't like it, try another one. It's
easy enough.
It's really pretty easy.
Yeah.
And as long as you're nice and respectful, people will really get down with you. You can go to Clark Street Ale House. You can go to the Twisted Spoke, Drum Bar, Fountainhead.
That's another good one. There's a bunch of scotch there, too.
There's a bunch of scotch.
Yeah.
Aaron really likes his Glenfarclas up at the Fountainhead.
That's a good one. That's a great bar. Tell me about your whiskeys in particular, a few.
So our whiskeys at Few, we're trying to do that Chicago style, kind of like I mentioned. We're trying to do something that's a little bit different than people are used to. Our bourbon tends to be a very, very spicy bourbon. That's intentional. Our rye drinks a little bit fruity because we use a wine yeast. We try to make our products a little bit distinctive and a little different than the rest, because at the end of the day, the folks down in Kentucky make some really good products, and we need to make stuff that's different in order to compete with them. So that's what we strive to do.
I love it. What is it? What makes the spiciness in the bourbon?
In the bourbon, we get a lot of our spiciness from a high rye content, as well as from a Belgian beer yeast that we use to ferment, as well as in the barrels that we use that come out of Minnesota. So everything we do has that effect. And what we're driving at with our bourbon is that big, heavy spice.
Mm-hmm.
Cinnamon, clove, black pepper, a little bit of white pepper. That's the kind of goal with the few bourbon, is to have that big, heavy, spicy note.
I love it. I love that. And I mean, I think when we think about rye and bourbon in particular, our brain stops at grain. We don't think about like wine yeast and things like that. What are other surprising elements that are sometimes found in whiskeys?
I think you're going to get a lot of interesting stuff. And again, whiskey is really constrained only by the creativity of the people making it.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll find just amazing flavors all over the board, ranging from, like I was talking about with the cinnamon and clove in our bourbon. You'll get some black cherry or some pear from our rye. You can go to other whiskeys, you know, say, for example, like a Templeton rye with all that crazy, heavy white pepper. Super spicy, a little astringent. Really nice if that's what you're in the mood for. You can cross over into Scotland and find some amazing, super heavy, peaty whiskeys like your Lafroigs, your Ardbegs. Lots of Band-Aid-y, saline, salty flavors. Or you can cross over into the Highlands, get something a lot fruitier. You can cross over into Taiwan with some amazing Kavalan whiskeys. The world of whiskey is really big, wide, and wide open, and there really is something for everyone.
Yeah, yeah, it seems that way. I mean, it really is. We think of it being like a really straightforward, especially bourbon. We think it's all kind of the same. It's super American. It's this thing. It's really kind of complex, and the more you read about it, the more it's in international spaces and has very distinct regional notes. Almost when we think of wine, like a Riesling from this particular area, mm-hmm. things like that. Is that about grain? Is that about growing conditions, or is that about the brewing style of that region?
I think whiskey's a little different than wine, and I think everything really matters. So yeah. With wine, it's very much directly derived from the fruit. With bourbon and with whiskey, there's going to be influences from the grain, but there's also going to be influences from the yeast, and there's going to be influences from the cooking technique. So there's going to be influences from how it's distilled and what style still it's distilled on, and there's going to be differences based on the wood it's in, barrel entry proof, how long has it aged, how short has it aged, what's the char level on the barrels, what's the toast level on the barrels.
What's the difference between char and toast?
So char is kind of like blackening or burning, mm-hmm. and toast is going to be a little bit, not to be a jerk, but it looks like toast.
Okay.
It's a little bit more of like a toasty color, so just put white bread in the oven,
okay.
and you'll get a little toasty color, or if you leave it in there for a little bit longer at a higher temp, it's going to get all black and charred.
And so is that, so it's a spectrum, really, from toast to char.
There's a whole spectrum.
Got it.
There's different levels of toast and different levels of char, and you can get all those from different time frames and how you do it, and is the wood air-dried or kiln-dried. There are so many different characteristics that can affect the flavors of whiskey that it can be a little challenging mm-hmm. to pick out just one that's the most important.
Well, I think we've started talking about barrels a lot more as like the... bourbon, you know, like the bourbon county stouts and those kind of like the barrel aged beers and those heavier beers started being such a piece of conversation in like the craft beer space.
For sure.
But so what is your, at Few, what is the barrel approach that you take?
So for our barrels, we're always, again, looking to try to find something new and different. So all of our wood comes out of Minnesota. We work at the family owned cooperage up in Avon, Minnesota. Dear personal friends of ours. We work with them constantly. Minnesota oak, a little shorter growing season because it's farther north than a lot of the big boys get their barrels down in, you know, Arkansas, Mississippi, Tennessee. Shorter growing season, tighter grain changes the character of the whiskey.
Cool. So what's coming up new and next at Few?
At Few, we're always trying to innovate and do something really, really fun, neat, and different. We just released our Few American Whiskey, which is a vatting of our bourbon rye as well as a malt whiskey that we made. We are in conversations with two different rock bands to do some collaborations across music and whiskey.
That's fun. How does that work?
Depends on the band, depends on how it's working out. Everything's going to be a little different, but in particular, I'm excited about both of these because they're two of my favorite bands of all time. So the opportunity to work with them is you know, very fun.
That sounds pretty exciting. Okay, great. So where can people go to find out more about Few Distillery?
At Few Spirits, you can find us at fewspirits.com. You can find us on all your social medias at Few Spirits. You can come check us out and have a tour up in Evanston at 918 Chicago Avenue. We're just down the alley when you get there. We do tours all summer long. We do parties. Send us an email, info@fewspirits.com. We don't bite.
I say yes to all those things. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Paul Holetko, the founder of Few Distillery, for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy.
So, like I said, that was a conversation that I had earlier today with Paul Holetko from Few Distillery. Really interesting. I love that that's right here in Chicago, that you can go up there, you can take that tour. As he said, when he was here this afternoon, there was a tour going on as we were talking. So that's very, very cool. I know there's tons of distilleries, but it was cool to talk with him. And I love, we didn't get to talk much about the labels, but he's a little bit afterwards as he was leaving, we talked more about how that label is, he's really focused on making that kind of this classic artwork around the World's Fair and the 6 days that like that all these people were here. So I think that's pretty cool. So you should go check them out, do the things. He brought us a little bit, so we might have to sample some of that. That's a thing that's going to happen for sure. Anyway, so that's going to do it for us for the whiskey show. So we're going to wrap things up and we will see you next time. But in the meantime, if you follow me on social media, I'm at Amy Guth on Twitter and on Instagram. I'll be sharing some links for all the things that were mentioned tonight on the show and putting you in touch with all those guests as promised and linking you to articles we referenced, all those things. And then, of course, when the podcast is ready, in case you tuned in late or you just had such a good time you want to hear it all again, I'll be sure and tweet that podcast out. So we shall see you next time.